Hello, Cinnabar Moths, any kind of moth you'd like to be. Welcome to the Writer's Triangle, Cinnabar Moths podcast about all things publishing and books. Today we are here with Ash Thurman, our writer in residence for Cinnabar Moth Literary Collection. Ash, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm great. I'm fantastic.
Awesome. Lovely to hear. So today we're going to be talking about diversity in writing. And I was wondering, when did you first learn about the concept of diversity and what does it mean to you?
Since this is a non-visual medium, I'm white. I'm very European. That's how white I am. I just want to make that very clear. But I was very, very, I think, lucky personally to grow up, and, you know, I have no problem talking about this, in Texas, Central Texas. And in my specific area that I lived in, I was the only white kid. I was surrounded by a lot of kids who were Hispanic, who were first generation immigrants from Mexico and South America. And so I was exposed really, really, really early to something that was other than white. I had this very firsthand exposure to this secondary culture that was not my primary culture. And so once you have that, it makes it really easy to jump to like the next thing. Cause like I had friends across all, religions and racial backgrounds all the way through elementary, not as much in middle school. Cause I went to a different school in middle school that wasn't as diverse, but then in high school as well. And so I was always around. I was very lucky to be in a setting where I was always around people of other religions, people of other races, people of ethnic backgrounds. And so that coupled with just like this kind of ravenous curiosity about what does the rest of the world look like? I feel like I was really lucky to always live in a place, a mental place and a physical place where I understood, hey, there are other people out there that are not like me. That come from different backgrounds, and that makes it really easy to just be like, yay, diversity, because we're all different, because I can literally see it physically in my day-to-day life. Even though I wasn't like in a big city, I wasn't like in New York or LA or anything where that would be even more, you know, present, but I still was able to see that in my day-to-day life, which makes it really easy to internalize.
Okay, so for you, diversity has just been something that you've lived with kind of your entire life, the concept.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always had access to information about other places. I was that kid, giant nerd. So I was that kid who was watching like the Discovery Channel back when it was still like educational, Discovery Channel and TLC, and like I would be watching these, you know, the more anthropological shows, like, oh, the culture of Papua New Guinea and like all this kind of good stuff. And like I was living, like, my parents were really cool about being like, you need to know things about this, kind of like let me go off. And like, so between the day-to-day life of just seeing people that were different around me and then being allowed to like just go full force into learning about whatever I wanted to learn and then learning about other people in the process, yeah, it just made it real easy to be like, oh yeah, the world is big and vast and other people exist.
Okay, so you've had this exposure to the concept of diversity very, very early. And what does diversity mean to you? Like, if you get back into the nitty gritty of it.
It's the idea, like, again, it's that idea of, like, it means to me, like I said, it's that idea of there are other people out there that have a different experience than you. That have a different experience than your neighbor, that are living a life that is not yours. And so the idea of diversity in the sense of like a media sense is being able to include those other experiences or recognize that other experiences exist and include them in fictional media and having fictional media or media in general that appeals to people from multiple different walks of life. Cause like right now, you know, we don't always in the United States in particular. So it's the idea of recognizing that in the forming of casts, in the like a cast of like a of novel or a game or a show, and in the recognition that, hey, other worldviews exist, and actually like showing it, that like that's kind of what it means to me. It's being able to express that kind of rich tapestry of what the universe looks like.
Okay, so it's a combination of the understanding that there is this rich tapestry that you speak of, but
right.
also giving the exposure to the
right.
alternative and various walks of life and views of life and experiences that people have had.
Right, exactly.
Okay. And so if we go, you mentioned media, if we pare it down to just specifically writing,
right.
do you consider yourself to be part of the diversity in writing?
See, that's a very tricky, like, I feel like that's a very tricky question, because I feel like a lot of times when we're talking about things like, you know, vectors of experience and like vectors of oppression in particular, there's this kind of tendency to have like this little like punch card feeling, like, oh, I'm white, so I don't get a punch for that. Aha, but I am feminine presenting. That's a punch card. That's my, you know, that's an oppression. That's because I think when we talk about like diversity, we also have to talk about oppressed groups and that kind of thing, and marginalized groups, because those are the ones that tend to suffer, so to speak, from the lack of diversity in writing and media and that kind of stuff. So like I said, there's this punch card effect where it's like, oh, okay, well, I have this difference, and I have this difference, punch, 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 punch. And so, you know, I'm kind of left with like, oh, okay, I'm white, so from that vector of like a racial vector of diversity, I'm not doing anything. Like, and another white writer, there's plenty of us, as far as like in the United States in particular. But I'm a feminine presenting writer. Well, I work in sci-fi and fantasy, and feminine presenting people have a harder time in sci-fi and fantasy. So in that regard, I would be an element of diversity that's against the sort of masculine norm that you see in sci-fi and fantasy and horror. And yeah, at the same time, I'm also a queer writer, and I'm a non-binary writer. And so in like a general sense, yes, that is a group that is underrepresented in media as a whole. And then within like the queer writing space, because my specific combination of, you know, letters, so to speak, is a little bit different than what you see in what little mainstream queer writing exists. So it's like yes and no. Like, it feels really awkward to say like, oh yeah, no, I'm absolutely part of like the quote unquote diversity, because I have all these vectors that in my specific genres are not mainstream. So I was like, yeah, no, I totally am. But at the same time, it's like, it feels a little presumptuous, because to me, like, diversity is a good thing. It's like it's a thing that we need more of. And so in my effort to constantly be uplifting voices that are even more marginalized than mine, it feels kind of presumptuous to be like, well, I'm also diverse, but I also kind of am. It's a very, like, I feel like I'm rambling there, but it's a very, like, complex, nuanced question when you consider the various vectors of marginalization.
Mm-hmm. And so for you, you feel kind of stuck with this question because...
Right.
It feels almost like you're ticking off boxes rather than actually talking about diversity.
Ostensibly, yeah, because it's like, okay, because you have to kind of talk about, okay, what does diversity mean in the context of like, oh, if you're trying to build a diverse bookshelf, okay, what does right. a diverse bookshelf look like? And in a theory, that would be pulling authors from multiple different races, pulling authors from multiple different genders, pulling authors from multiple different sexual orientations and ethnic backgrounds and religions. And so in a sense, we're all part of diversity because we're all different. But then you also have to acknowledge that there is a mainstream trend towards certain demographics. So it's like making the split between how far off the quote unquote, like, it's a split between having to define, okay, what's the mainstream? Like, what needs to be diverted from? And are you far enough away from that to consider yourself, like, a diversity contributor?
Right. And so it feels, it's, do you fulfill enough boxes to consider yourself different from the mainstream?
Basically, yeah.
Right. Yeah, that is quite a difficult thing to properly measure because just speaking as myself, I'm black, but I'm also a man. And there's a lot more male writers than female writers. So
Exactly. It's those vectors. It's those vec yeah, I'm white, but I'm queer and femme presenting. So it's like there's plenty of white writers, but you know, it gets weirder with queer and femme presenting writers. So it's like
yeah, I do think that is a fair thing to point out about when it comes to the conversation around diversity is this sort of feeling of are you different enough to be considered different? I hadn't thought of it that way before, but that's quite, even thinking now, I wonder how would I answer this question for myself? And I think on like a knee-jerk reaction, I would say, yeah, of course I'm part of diversity in writing. Am I?
Right. Like it's a very like, 'cause it's like, it's really easy for me to, it's like really easy for me to look at other people's writing and be like, ah, yes. What an absolute, or they're like, it's like a, 'cause it's so collective. It's like, it's, how do you say like an individual writer is, how do you say an individual writer is necessarily part of diversity? Well, I think it's more like you have to look at, like, at the collective of like a publisher. Or like, oh, this magazine, did this magazine pull from a diverse pool of experiences? Like, so it feels more like a, you have to look at it as a collective. You can't look at it as an individual thing. It's like a collective. Oh, and even, and I think, like I said, it's like, even with like in your own writing, you know, like, are you considering diversity in the collective, you know, collective approach of your own writing? As opposed to like individual story, like, can I, oh, is this short story diverse? I don't know. There's two people in it. But, you know, is are as everything you've written looked at it as a unit showing a showing an attempt at creating diversity within your characters and within your settings.
Right. And so for your perspective on it, my understanding, it's more about the body of work for an author or the body of works for a publisher or a literary magazine of who and what they're publishing.
Right. It's like, okay, have you, cause yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
What do you
so
have, what do you have on your bookshelf?
it's something in a sense where you can't look at it so individualistic. You have to look at it more of a macro perspective of the overall. Are we seeing enough different trees?
Basically, yeah.
I don't know if trees is the right metaphor, but I just think like a
We're gonna
forest,
go with
right?
it. We're gonna go with it. I mean, yeah, that might not be the best metaphor because the vast majority of forests would only have maybe two or three species of trees because of the like, ecological niches, but we'll go for it. That's fine.
But you know, there might be fungi in there as well.
True. So it's the full forest ecosystem.
Let's
Is
go
your
with that.
forest ecosystem healthy? Does it have an appropriate level of like of predators versus prey versus plants for its, you know, its web, its food web. There you go. That's your metaphor.
Wonderful. It's grown into something
We've cracked
here.
it. We've cracked the code on diversity.
Ah, the wonders of being writers. We can invent these things. We have the minds
Perfected.
for it, right?
Exactly.
And so I guess something I want to ask you then is, do you feel like you have a diverse body of work?
I'm trying every single day. Like, I definitely grew up on a very specific, 'cause I'm a primarily sci-fi and fantasy writer with a little bit of horror thrown in. So I actively try to, okay, I'm developing this main character. What does this main character look like? What is this main character's, you know, ethnic background? I write fantasy so I can scoop by a lot of this kind of stuff. Like I don't have to actually pick like, oh, they're from Malawi. I can just be like, blah, they look like this. And so I actively do try to think about what my main characters look like, what they sound like, what the side characters look like and sound like, as far as like, real life racial and ethnic comparisons. Like, because we write sci-fi and fantasy, you're not usually drawing you're drawing inspiration from actual countries and actual cultures and stuff, but you're not necessarily doing like one for one things. But yeah, this, I try really hard to draw from multiple different histories and backgrounds and that kind of stuff. Because you do run into this a lot in sci-fi and fantasy in particular. There's a lot of just like medieval Europe inspired fantasy. So much medieval European inspired fantasy. And you know, I wrote a short story for a magazine that was set in the, that was it was more analogous to the Islamic Golden Age, where I was going for a more you know, Saudi Arabia in the Middle Ages kind of look and kind of feel, and how the characters were named, how the characters looked. So it's like, well, I'm still trying to be sensitive to the actual culture that this comes from. Like, I'm not trying to be like appropriative or anything. So there's definitely like a line there between like, it's really easy in fantasy settings to make people look however you want them to look, including skin color. Like, I can make as many people dark skinned as I want and no one's going to stop me, and I wouldn't want them to. And that's where I try to focus, is being like, okay, I'm not going to just have all my characters be white like me, you know, white, blonde hair, blue eye, green eye. That's also a big problem you see in fantasy. I'm going to mix it up. I'm going to have characters with 4C curly hair. I'm going to have, I'm working on a serial right now where my character wears a silk bonnet at night and like is putting beads in her hair for a party, and like that's just like a normal part of her existence with her extremely, you know, her, I think I decided on 3C hair. So that's what I try to do is like walk that line between like, oh, I'm white, so I have to be aware of like my limitations on lived experience for a character, but I also have the ability to research, you know, what living in that kind of body would be like physically, and then apply it in a fantasy setting, or have a little more leeway with like the cultural context, and include those things in my writing, and like don't just default to white because I happen to be white. That's what I try to do.
Okay, so your process for making sure that you have a diverse body of work involves doing the research to make sure that you're representing as accurately as you can the different cultures and different ethnic backgrounds that you are using as inspiration, even if it's not directly one-to-one, but as inspiration for the settings and for the characters that you're creating in your worlds.
Right, exactly. It's like I said, in fantasy, you get a lot of, like I said, you get a lot of leeway. You can make stuff up. Like you have the room to make stuff up. So it's like, okay, I got to make sure the thing I'm making up isn't necessarily going to be like problematic if I look at it down the line, and be like, oh shoot, I didn't realize I didn't know this thing. So I got to make sure I know everything. I got to know everything about the subject. That way, when I'm using it as a template for this fictional setting, I'm not inadvertently messing up something somewhere. Like,
right. That definitely makes sense. It's a matter of, you know, being appreciative and not just
appropriative. Right? Yeah, it's appreciative, not appropriative. But also like being, I think also it comes with being like willing to, you see this a lot with some people who are just like, I don't know, if I read a protagonist that is X, Y, and Z, I don't know if I could relate to them. And it's like, I'm sorry that you don't have the level of like empathy required to connect with someone who doesn't look like you. So that's another aspect of it. Like being able to connect with someone who doesn't look like you, being able to see the humanity deep down of literally everybody and just realize, oh, you know, there's I can still connect with this person. Because as a writer, you have to connect with your characters as well. And it's like, I don't have any problems with that. Like I can connect with a character at a character level while also keeping in mind, hey, they're going to have a technically different lived experience than me. I got to make sure that's correct. So like I can separate the connecting with them at the character, social character level, while still having that kind of technical aspect on top of it of like, okay, well, I also know that they're not going to do this thing with their hair because their hair looks different. You can do both, and I think that strengthens your ability to write as a whole, is being able to do both.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The ability to connect with experiences that aren't your own and being able to, I mean, that's kind of necessary for writing more
exactly
than just yourself as a character, right?
Right,
you
exactly
have to be able to have these completely separate entities that you could not see yourself actually doing the things they're doing, thinking the way they're thinking even, but you can still put yourself in the mindset of, if this character were to be doing something based off what they are, who they are, this is what they would do.
Exactly.
And having that be a real response that's, you know, realistic, you know.
Yeah,
if
exactly
this character's greedy, then they're going to behaving in a greedy fashion. If they're
right
kind, they're going to be kind.
Right. And if this person has experienced this certain experience based on their skin color, then they're going to react in a certain way, in a different, you know, it's like if they have this different set of experiences, they're going to react differently than I right would. And so many of our experiences are based on how we look and how we're perceived by society as a whole. So it's like, you know, getting all those things to mesh together.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And when it comes to this type of diversity, when it comes to a body of work, obviously there's the work that we can do as writers on an individual level to improve our personal bodies of work. But that's only kind of a drop in the ocean, in a sense, right? When
right
you compare it to publishers and editors of literary magazines who pump out and publish the collections of work of hundreds, thousands, honestly, millions of authors. So what do you think, to expand on this concept of diversity mm-hmm in books and bodies of work, what do you think publishers and editors of literary magazines can do to help increase this diversity in the publishing world?
It's definitely got to be that acknowledgement of bias. Like, you don't even realize you have these biases of like, oh, I expect my fantasy to look like this. I expect my sci-fi to look like this. Well, someone coming in from, okay, if you expect all your fantasy to look like medieval Europe, then yeah, when someone comes in with a story that is based out of, I don't know,
Japan,
right? Or their culture, Japan, we'll go to Japan. I was trying to think of something else. But yeah, if someone comes in with their cultural experiences of living in Japan or being Japanese or being even of Japanese descent, and so their story doesn't look like a European fantasy, and yet the publisher is expecting their fantasy to look European fantasy, then yeah, there's going to be this dissonance there. The publisher or the editor will say, of a set of a magazine, may not even necessarily realize they have. They may just be like, oh, this feels too exotic. And it's like, it's not exotic. It's Japanese. Like,
right,
people live in Japan. If anything, there's probably like, you know, it's like, oh, this is Asian inspired. Oh, that's too exotic. There are more Asian people collectively, you're speaking like Korea, Japan, China, you know, Taiwan, than there are white people. So like, sorry that you're like, you know, it's just because it's different than what you're familiar with doesn't mean that it's exotic. It just means it's different. And so I think having to overcome that bias of, oh, if it's different, it's too weird. And it's like, no, it's not, because people have that lived experience. You know, people have a direct experiences with these other cultural elements. It's weird to you, but not to them. And so getting past that and like, being able to getting past that and recognizing, hey, I have experiences I don't know about. Like, there are experiences in the world that I am not familiar with. I need to not be afraid of those experiences. I need to be open to like, oh, okay, this is what sci-fi could look like. This is what fantasy could look like. This is what horror could look like. This is what genre fiction could look like, outside of my perception. So it's being aware. It's being aware I have this bias, but also like actively seeking out like, it sounds silly to be like, because it really sounds like a diversity quota, and those aren't necessarily a good thing either. But at the same time, there are so many good writers out there of all backgrounds. And so if you set an actual physical quota of like, okay, so I want someone, I want to make sure I have writers of all these different demographics for whatever reason, you're going to find excellent writers in those demographics. And it's not going to be a case of, oh, they just got in because they're Black, or oh, they just got in because they're good. Like, we need to get over that. It's some of it's equitability, and some of it's just like, they can be both. A person can be like, a Black writer, for example, can be picked for a magazine for assurance of diversity within the magazine, but also because they're good. They're good at what they do. Like, those don't have to be separate concepts. I think we get caught up on that a lot, you know. The affirmative action days. I remember when I was a kid and that was like a whole big thing. It was an episode of ER about it. It was weird. But it's like, you can actively seek out diversity for the magazine. You can do, it's harder to do. I was like, one of my recommendations would be like blind, making sure that there's no names attached. But a lot of magazines already do that, because you can tell someone's cultural background in a diverse piece if they've chosen to do something that's like more connected. So that's I diverted there. But yeah, just like actively being aware of it, being aware that, hey, we should not just have, you know, straight white dudes in this magazine, maybe. That we should be aware of exactly who we are pulling into this magazine and looking at it and being like, yeah, you know, we have voices from all over the world. Cool. Great. Awesome.
Okay. So it sounds to me like there's two sides of it. One of it is the pushing against the kind of Eurocentrism that is very commonplace, and be like, okay, this doesn't feel like it matches my idea, because my idea is based off of this very Eurocentric concept of fantasy. So let me just pull back for a moment and look at it. Is it well written?
Yep.
And is it a fantastical world I could believe in?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And just in being able to not let that bias get in the way, to be able to accept, hey, there could be other reference points for a fantastical universe.
And then the other part is just actively saying, hey, we're going to pursue diverse writers. We're going to pursue things outside of the mainstream rather than just waiting for it to come to us.
Exactly. Like, going into the spaces where these writers of different backgrounds exist, I'm being like, hey, please submit, apply, submit, like increasing the pool. And also, and I think another big part of it is also, there's a lot of, because I think there's another aspect of diversity in that we don't talk about as much, and that is like financial access to things. And that is very, in the US in particular, that's very connected to race. It just is. It's all there is to it. But like, finding ways, but there's also, yeah, so there's this, if you have a submission fee on a magazine, and that submission fee is $20, you're only going to get the people who can afford that $20.
Right.
Which, I mean, yeah, some people $20 isn't, so some people $20 is nothing. To some people, $20 is half their grocery budget for the month. So are you making your magazine accessible to everyone, even in that regard? Are you making submissions to your magazines, or submissions to your publication, your querying process, whatever, are you making that accessible to as many people as possible? Or are you setting up unnecessary burdens? I'm not saying that like a $20 submission fee isn't, I mean, I don't know, it would depend from magazine to magazine. I've seen magazines who do both, but it's like, are you setting up unnecessary burdens to get a huge collection of people? Because I can tell you, back when I was, you know, a younger person, there were absolutely magazines I would have loved to have submitted to and felt like I was a good fit for, but I couldn't afford the $10 submission fee. I physically couldn't. And so those were opportunities that slipped on by because I physically couldn't afford them. So it's like, are you, so there's other ways that this could be a case. Like, are, if you're looking for, I'm having a hard time thinking of other examples, but it's like, yeah, are you making your submission process, your grading process accessible to as many people as possible?
Yeah, I do think that making sure that there's as few barriers to entry as possible.
Right.
Just kind of like clearing the path and be like, okay, we're trying to make this available to people. What are the things that we can cut out that make this harder?
Basically, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So here at Cinnabar Moth, we have a focus on diversity, and we do feel that it raises all voices. The mainstream point of view is already known. But what would you say to the people who argue against diversity and claim that it's silencing mainstream voices or mainstream points of view?
It's very much like that little bird meme of "am mad when things are not about me," you know, or, you know, not to necessarily reference a media franchise that's kind of in a situation right now, but like the whole like, we have 36 presents this year. Well, I had 37 last year. You know, it's the mainstream voices how are never going to not be mainstream. They're always going to exist. You're always going to have this demographic of authors that aren't going to get turned away. They're always going to have a place because they're the mainstream. And so there's no silencing occurring. It's not to come down too hard on white men, but I have to just for a minute because I have personally experienced a specific group of like white male writers who are suddenly like, oh my God, I have to work. Oh, all this, you know, all they want are people that are of this. All they want are people of this race. I have to like work so much harder to like get my stuff seen. And it's like, yeah, welcome to what it's been like for 90% of the world at this point. Like, do you know how hard it's been for how long for women, for female and femme presenting writers to get seen in sci-fi and fantasy? You know how hard some of these non-white fantasy and sci-fi writers have had to work to get their stuff seen? And it's like it should be equally hard for everybody. It should be like this kind of equitable, everyone's having to fight everybody. It doesn't matter, you know, what your background is. But up to this point, if you are not of a certain demographic, you've had to work extra hard to be seen. And so now it's just like the people who are like, well, now I can't get my stuff seen. It's like, yeah, welcome to the club. We've been doing this whole time. Now you just know what it's like. Please learn something from this.
And I think to follow up on that as well, that this concept of, oh, this one place is just looking for, you know, let's say black writers. And because right. I'm not black, I can't submit to them. Well, how about the 25 other places that you could submit to?
Exactly. Exactly. It's like, it's like, okay, so you don't get this one. Oh, well, you have a bajillion others. It's fine. Like, it's fine. You're going to be fine. Heaven forbid you have to work a little harder. Maybe your writing's just not very good. I'm so mean. I'm very, very mean sometimes when it comes to this because I've just had so many negative experiences with like this specific mindset, and it's these people that are just like there's definitely a certain subset of people who have, for various demographic purposes, have basically had stuff just kind of handed to them, and those are the people that are gonna be the loudest complaining about diversity. And it's like, you've had things handed to you your whole life. You have been presumed to be the best in your field or the best at what you do because of your demographic. You are just now happening to be learning. You're just now, it's like a mirror's being held up and they're suddenly realizing, hey, guess what? You're not the best. You're not the only thing that exists in the world. Other people exist who may be better than you at what you do, or maybe have more experience, not better, but like have more experience in what you do. And now you have to face that. Oops.
Yeah, I do think that there may be times when people are like, well, I got away with being kind of mediocre because I happen
exactly.
to have this set of pre-given
exactly.
traits of being white
yeah.
and male, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like,
exactly.
Well, I kind of get a pass on the other things. I don't have to put in that little bit of extra quality that the people who
yeah.
are not in the mainstream have had to put in just to be noticed.
Exactly. Exactly. And so now they're suddenly seeing what that looks like and they don't like it. And it's like, yeah, it's pretty bad, isn't it? It's in it. Isn't it pretty annoying? Guess what we've all been dealing with. Cool.
And, you know, a little bit of healthy competition is not a bad thing.
Right.
And
it's
not like
it's,
there's...
Yeah, it's really not.
And it's not as if there's only a couple places to submit to in the world.
Right. And it's in the nature of, and because publishing has just changed so considerably, you don't even have to go, look, we could talk about this later, but like, you don't even have to go through a publisher anymore.
Right.
Like if you, okay, you're mad because the magazine you're submitting to, you know, won't like, so you're of a certain demographic and you're mad that you can't seem to find a magazine that'll take you because they want diverse, they want other people, they want these, this affirmative action, blah, blah, blah. Well, then you can get your butt onto Amazon Kindle and you can market your own book. Because if it's good, if it's genuinely good, then you should be able to market it on the fact that it's good. So it's like you have all of us have the power now to do that kind of thing. So you don't have to rely on things like magazines and publishing houses anymore if you don't want to. So if you think that your piece is good enough, but oh, no one will take you because all they want is diversity, well, then you get your butt on Kindle Unlimited and prove it. If it's good, people will find it.
And so speaking of people's work and kind of diverting a little bit away from the Main Street topic and moving
right.
to a more personal topic on you
right.
and your writing. In your writing, you touch on pain and loss. And I wanted to ask you, what kind of drives that focus with some of your writing?
It's one of those, I think, one, pain and loss are very universal kind of concepts. My life growing up, it wasn't like the worst thing ever. Like, I'm not going to sit here and like pretend that I had like, oh, this horrific life or something. But like, my family as a whole has gone through so much bullshit over the years of death and disease and like, of just horrific things like happening to us like collectively that, I had to learn to process grief really, really young. I get a really, really young age, like a lot younger than a lot of people do. I think a lot earlier than a lot of people in like mainstream do. And so that kind of just like that carries through, but I also feel like they're just very universal experiences. That like, oh, there's a mourning a life that never got to happen, or of mourning the future that could have happened but didn't, and like all these, like there's just this kind of complex of like a complex of sort of like I'm trying to think how to say it. It's like, it's this complex of like, you have the ability to, like, for me personally, how I see it is, it's like, I feel like I've mourned situations more than I've ever mourned people. Like, oh, why didn't I get to live this life? Why didn't I get to do this thing? Why did I have to go through this when I could not have? And so, and so it's kind of like, so there's this element of that. But then also, I also grew up in a family, and I got this from my mom a lot. I grew up in a family where I was one of the people that kind of wasn't allowed, not to have emotions, but like, I was one of the people, like, I was the one that had to be like the stronger person in the context of various and different family situations. Like, okay, this person's life is falling apart. I have to, even as a kid, you know, I had to be there to be like, okay, I'm going to help. I'm going to do this, and like not get to process my own emotions as much in the time. And so that kind of builds up over the years. And so a lot of it is like writing about pain loss, a lot of it's catharsis. Of like, I didn't get to properly experience this thing as a kid. So now I'm getting to experience it as an adult retrospectively and retroactively. And it's like, God, that sucked. That really sucked. And I never really got to experience how much it sucked then. I'm going to experience that now as an adult. But now that kind of builds up a lot of emotions and you have to channel that somewhere. So...
Okay, so for you, it comes from a combination of kind of the universality of loss and grief, but also the more personalized experience of going through the grieving process that you didn't have the opportunity to, or necessarily the space and time to in the past. And then part of the processing process for you is being able to then spill that onto the page, so to speak.
Right. And like kind of, which is why a lot of my other, like a lot of my writing also has a lot of like, I keep having like CPTSD occur as a recurring theme in some of my writing, where it's like, oh, this horrible thing's happened in my childhood. And now I'm experiencing the PTSD from that as an adult. And that keeps happening. And I'm not sure. And I didn't realize it. And I was like, oh, I should work through that. I should work through that because that theme keeps popping up. I should deal with that. Right. Yeah, because sometimes you don't even realize what you're doing until you've done it. And then you're like, oh, I should go to therapy.
I've revealed something and learned something about myself in my writing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I definitely do think that there is a lot of self-learning and a lot of processing that can go into writing that can be very useful. At times, to help us to grow or just to kind of settle ourselves. Well, hopefully be able to settle ourselves, even if it's not necessarily during the writing process.
Right. It's when you're writing, it's because it's funny because lots of times you don't notice it until you like look back on like several of your pieces. And then you look back and you go, I wrote about this particular thing a lot. Why did I keep drawing from that as a point of inspiration? Huh. Oh. Oop.
I definitely do think that is something that can happen quite a bit more than people might expect who, from the outside looking in, you know, people who don't necessarily write, looking at writers, like, they just create these things, and it's cool. There's a lot more behind that. Speaking of surprising people and things that people might not expect from the outside looking in, do you have anything that you think would surprise people about your personal journey to become a fiction author?
I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where, I mean, I guess what it could be, I guess like the one thing that could definitely like, I think, I don't know if it's surprising or not, but like, I was actively discouraged from pursuing writing as a professional as all my childhood. Like, it was very much a, my family was very, very monetary wealth focused as far as like what they wanted for me. My mom was very much like, oh, you know, you're going to go off and you're going to have your, you know, your STEM career, blah, blah, blah. Then you can write your books on the side. You can write your books on the side. And like, that didn't happen, clearly. But yeah, there was like a lot of really kind of like active discouragement from actually pursuing any kind of writing field or any kind of creative field professionally, which that surprised a lot of people, actually, because I'm also an actor. And so I remember when I was graduating high school, a lot of people in my own theater department were really surprised. They're like, where are you going to college? And I was like, I'm going to this school for this program. And they're like, you are? I was like, yeah. They're like, oh, we just assumed that you were going to go into like an acting based field, or you're going to get everyone I knew assumed I was going to be going to get like a BFA, or I was going to be going into like theater education or something. And we're like totally baffled that I was actually going hard into a STEM field. And so that's just been kind of like a thing. It's like a lot of people outside my family expected me to be going into a creative field professionally. Within my family, that was never the expectation. It was like, no, you're going to go, you're going to make a lot of money, you're going to build me my house in the lake. then you can write on the side in your free time. And that completely did not happen. So my mom was very surprised.
Okay. So that's something that surprised your mother.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like she's like, I just don't know where you get your stories. And I was like, well, you raised me, so you should be able to know where I get my stories. So it's funny. She's fine with it now. It took her quite a while to kind of come around to like, oh, things are not the way I had hoped they would go for you, but okay, cool.
I think it's good that she's come around. You know,
it helped when I gave her her first physical copy of a book I was in and like signed it for her, and she was like, she's odd. I love my mom to death, but she's very strange.
And so you've been published, you've got your body of work that's going out, that's out there in the world. Have you found the world of publishing has been welcoming to your point of view and your voice? I know you mentioned earlier that you mostly do sci-fi.
I do. So that's such a difficult question, because it's like right now I have my stuff that's in my magazines that are not published by me, but then I also have stuff that I've done self-publishing with. Like I have like a self-published serial, and I have like a self-published romance novel because I was bored. It's a sci-fi romance novel, to be very clear. It's under a pen name, which I'll share. I don't mind. But it's in self-published. It's more of like a for fun kind of thing. And at the same time, I was also querying a reason I wrote it is because I was querying a fantasy novel. And I was like, okay, I need something else to do while I'm doing this. I'm just write this for fun as a writing practice. And I ended up liking it. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to self-publish it then. And it's like, okay, well, the romance novel has got some really good reviews, but it hasn't really picked up a very big readership. And okay, then this novel hasn't gotten through the querying process yet. And like, oh, this short story has been rejected. Like all my short stories from a certain magazine that I've been applying to for like years have been rejected every single year. But at the same time, I've been picked up by other magazines, and I'm on other writing teams. And so it's hard to know if it's a, oh, you don't like what I have to say, or a just, you're kind of weird, so you got a weird niche, so you're going to have a smaller audience to begin with. And then there's marketing involved. Like, oh, am I marketing these self-published pieces correctly? And so I have to look at it from the perspective of like, it's hard to know like where the sort of fault is and all those things. It's like, oh, maybe like I just haven't, maybe like, oh, I've submitted this magazine and it's like, oh man, they actually liked my piece and they liked the quote unquote voice of the piece, but oh, they had two stories that were really similar, and so they had to just make calls somewhere. Like you never really know what's going on in the back end. And so I kind of have to look at it from the perspective of like, okay, what's out there and what's successful? Like who's reading what, what's getting picked up and what's getting published. And that gets really difficult. That ends up being a slightly better barometer of like, oh, these platforms are welcoming to these concepts or these voices, these views. And it's like 50-50. Like, it's like, I definitely see I, like with trad publishing, like I see things on the shelves and none of it really looks like what I'm writing. But with trad publishing, since they're very, very, it's hard to know, okay, is it just because it's chicken and egg? It's a chicken and egg kind of thing. It's like, oh, if a trad publisher took a chance on what I'm writing, would you then see more of like what I'm writing on the shelves? Because, oh, all of a sudden that's the new trend. Because like, because trad publishing is so trend heavy that you really can't even use it as a good indicator of whether your stuff's good or not, or whether they want to hear from you or not. Because they're just on trend. They have trends that they're going for. Oh, you didn't write a vampire book. I don't want to hear it. I don't care how good it is. I'm looking for vampires right now. So that's the kind of problem with trad publishing, from my perspective, is you never really know. Like, okay, why don't you give my voice a shot, even though it's not what you're looking for? But it's hard to know why they wouldn't. You know, it's hard to know, like, oh, is it me personally, or is it just not what your trend is? It's not what the trend is this season. So I have to, again, I have to look at it from the perspective of what's out there, and what's out there is not what I want to. I write what I write from, like, the perspective of my stuff that's still not published yet. I write that because I don't see it out there. Like, it's the stories I want to read, but they don't seem to exist out in the world. So I'm going to write them. But if they don't exist, why don't they exist yet? Is it because people don't want to read them? Or is it because people haven't thought to write them? Or, like, what is the, what's the X factor there?
Okay, so for you, it's difficult to be able to answer this question with a definite, I feel welcome or unwelcome, because you don't know what's stopping your work from necessarily being published.
Right, exactly.
To a certain extent, it's a problem of a lack of transparency in the process.
Yeah, like if I get, like when I was querying my most recent, when I was querying my manuscript, I wasn't getting any feedback on why no, someone didn't want it. None. It was just like, oh, not what I'm looking for at this time. Okay, well, why not? Like, what about it was not something you were looking for?
Right.
Because I don't know that I would necessarily change it. Like, I wrote what I wrote for a reason. But it lets me know, okay, this is what trad publishing is looking for right now. Cool. I'm gonna think through it. And like with my sci-fi romance, I know why it's not really getting the kind of traction that like other sci-fi romance gets, and that's because I have genetic engineering in it with like, and I know why. Because I went a very hard sci-fi route, but it's still a romance novel. It's just got aliens. And I know what the alien romance market looks like, and it's not what I wrote, but I kind of don't care because it's what I wanted to read. Like, it's the kind of story I want if I'm going to, like, goof off and read an alien romance novel. So that one, I'm just kind of like, I'm aware of what's going on there. And that's not necessarily a view and a voice thing. That's the alien romance market has a very specific demographic that reads it. And I'm just not quite hitting the exact same markers because I'm more of a traditional sci-fi writer that just happened to include romance versus a romance with a sci-fi skin. So I know what's happening there. That's only because it's self-publishing. Like self-publishing, like, you can actually see it a lot clearer.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me. With,
right.
you know, if you write something that doesn't appeal to the audience, the market for that genre,
right,
or that niche within a genre, even.
Right, like you're not gonna get as many hits, right, even if it's good, right, you know. So you have to accept that. So you have two options there. You either write to market, which is hard in self-publishing in particular. Either you write to market and just write what people want to read, even if you don't necessarily care about it, or you just accept the fact that, hey, I wrote something weird, but I don't care because I like it.
Yeah, I definitely think that can sometimes be a difficult balance for people who are authors who are trying to reach their audience, but also their stories that they want to write don't quite fit necessarily with what the readers are looking for usually.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, you're writing something that you enjoy.
Right. And like, I'm very, and see, I'm from the, excuse me, I have a cat yelling at me. so if you hear screaming, that's what that is. If I'm a very peculiar reader. I don't read to trends. It's like I know what I like, and it's a very specific thing, and so I'm constantly trying to find this specific thing, and it's never been on trend, literally ever. So I'm reading stuff from like all back. I mean, I'm having to go back as far as possible time wise to find the things I want to read because it's never been on trend. It's never going to be on trend. I don't care. I love it. So I'll just, you know. So that's the perspective I take at it from. It's like, oh, it's not on trend. But you know what? Someone's going to find it. Someone's going to like it.
And so following up on that with the, you know, writing not to the mainstream.
Right.
Not writing to these trends. Do you have any a piece of advice that you would give to your fellow authors who are not in the mainstream and are writing or wanting to write about topics or point of views that are not part of the mainstream, that aren't part of the trend?
Yeah, so a lot of it comes down to, so it's kind of, I think it's like a two-part kind of like thing to that. Like, mainstream. It kind of comes down to what you're considering mainstream. Like, if you're talking about from a diversity perspective, I want to write characters that aren't necessarily mainstream, that are more like diverse, that are off brand or whatever. Well, let me back up a little bit on that, because I feel like I'm drifting.
Two parts here. One is, go with the topic we were just talking about, where it's like not to trend, more niche.
Right. So in that regard, and that's the thing, that's where I was kind of sitting anyway, is just write what you like. Because I think I would much rather read something very, very weird that is nothing like anything else, but it really feels like the author genuinely likes the subject matter. Like, if you like what you're writing, if you are invested in what you're writing, that comes through the writing. And there is always going to be if your experiences aren't as unique as you think they are, in the perspective of, if you wrote it, that means you like it. If you wrote it because you like it, someone else out there is going to like it. There are going to be other people out there that share enough lived experiences with you share enough interest with you as a person to like what you've written, if you like what you've written. It's like almost impossible to write something that only you like. Like, there's gonna be somebody else out there who likes what you write. And so it's a matter of finding that person, finding those people, finding the market for, finding that niche, finding where you can slither in and be like, hello, I'm here, I exist. It's just like pushing forward and being like, you know, I'm gonna write what I'm gonna write. Because if you write to trend and you don't like trend, it's gonna come through. It's going to come through. You're going to read it, and it's going to be boring, and it's going to be less. It's going to be heartless. It's going to be lacking an essential spark. And so, there's value in something that's a little bit different.
And so let your creative spark be ignited with the things that you enjoy.
Right, because I love weird books. I don't like a lot of like really main. Whether this is a remnant of my pick me era, I don't know, or my I'm not like other people era. If it's really, really mainstream, I'm less inclined to actually like read it, because it's probably going to be appealing to a very like broad audience, which is fine, but I'm probably going to find it boring. I'm going to be able to like, oh, okay, that's just this. I'm going to be able to read it and be like, oh, that's this narrative aspect, that's this trope, that's this character, and be like, blah, I've read it before. But if a book is weird, I am way more likely to pick it up.
I can definitely understand that, because this is not quite books, but games, for example, have a
Oh,
similar
yeah.
thing where a lot of things are following a certain kind of formula, right? That's the same for books, games, different media have this formula for what appeals to a large audience. And so I tend not to play a lot of mainstream games, although I do play quite a few games, just because I know what's gonna happen. I know it's coming, and I can't really get invested because I can see it coming down the line. But certain movies as well have that issue for me. Certain books as well have that issue for me. I'm like, okay, I know exactly where this is going to go before I even pick it up. So what's
Right.
the point?
That's me. I'm that way. Yeah. Like, and sometimes it's fine. Sometimes that's fun. Like, sometimes you're like, sometimes there's a lot of comfort in like knowing what's going to happen down the line. But sometimes you want to be like challenged and you want to be like, yeah, I want to be surprised. I want to be intrigued. I want to see new concepts. And I see a lot.
I think there's always going to be an appeal for people who, even if you take a trope and you spin it just a little bit, add that little bit of yourself into it, and suddenly it's experimental, it's different.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like
And so,
taking chances within your own genre and that kind of thing.
yeah, and so I think that that's really good advice to give people is to stay true to what keeps them interested. Because if you're interested in your own writing, then other people will also have an interest. You're not that unique, even if you are in your own unique person.
I definitely think loving your own writing is really huge. I interact with a lot of authors who will go back and talk about being like, oh my God, editing my work is such a slog and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, yeah, there's definitely an element of slogginess with editing because you're trying to figure out the best word here. But I never get tired of reading my own work. Ever. Like, I don't know if that's narcissism or something, but like I always like to go back and reread things I've already written. Like I'm able to constantly revel in the act of creation. I never get tired of what I wrote. Like obviously there comes a point where like, oh my God, I read the same passage 17 times looking for commas, and so now I'm tired of reading it. But like yeah, that kind of like dread feeling of, oh my God, I hate reading my own work. And it's like, I think you might need to readjust how you consider your own writing, because if you hate what you write,
Right.
ooh.
If you can't enjoy your work, that's a concern.
Yeah, that's
Enjoy
like it's
yourself.
yeah, exactly. Like you don't do it just because you feel like you have to.
I do think there is a very essential kind of heart that comes to stories where you can tell that the writer enjoyed it.
Right, exactly.
And so I want to talk about you as a writer a little bit. Move it a little bit away from advice to other writers, but more to you specifically. What is your goal as a writer? Do you have a particular goal?
I am a realist. I'm at a stage in my life where I am one very privileged that if I write and I never make a dime with writing ever again, I'm still fine. I have my other jobs, my other freelance. I'm good in that regard. So I have to I have to consistently acknowledge that privilege because some people don't get that. So for me, it's a matter of I want this is gonna sound strange, but like I also have to be realistic in the fact that the vast majority of like writers don't make a lot of money. So for me, it's not about money. It's not really about career, because career implies a level of like monetary compensation allows you to live. Like that would be great. Like that would be awesome to be able to be in a place where I could sell books and I could sell stories and make enough in a year to be at least a little self-sufficient. And that's never going to happen. It's very unlikely it's going to happen. So I don't reach for that. But I would love to be able to be at a convention with a little table of books I've written, no matter if it's through whatever methodology. Trad publishing, self-publishing, whatever. Because I think, because to back up, one of the things I did used to want, I was shooting for like a consistent traditional publishing, but in recent years, like the publishing market has shifted a lot, and so that's kind of like off my goal list. I'm like, But basically, to be able to have books that I've self-published or through some traditional publishing mechanism, be able to sit at a convention and have a table of books and have somebody come up to me and be like, oh my God, I love your books. I already own a copy. I brought it for you to sign. I'm also here to buy the next one. That's like, that's my goal. That's my moment of like, oh my God, I've connected with someone, or they've read something I've written and they felt seen. And they've been like, oh my God, I so connect with this character. Or like, oh my God, I've never seen a character like this before that I can connect. That's what I want. That's what I want. Because I want that fan action, but not necessarily like in a famous kind of way. Just like the connection with somebody else.
So for you, you want your writing to connect with somebody and right. Be able to experience that connection as well on your end.
Right, exactly. And to know that, like, I can put a book out and people are going to be excited for it and be like, oh my God, it's their next book. Oh my God, I love the other book. I'm so excited for this next one. Because that's how I feel with some of my favorite authors, where it's like, oh my God, I'm willing to read anything they wrote. I might not like it as much as something else they wrote, but I'm willing to read it because I love that author so much, because they connect with me, because they see me. That's what I want to do with somebody else. Like, there are so often I'll read an author where I'm like, oh my God, how are you inside my head? And I want to do that to somebody else. Like, that's what I want.
I can remember vividly certain authors who have written books that actually moved me. Because I struggle personally to be moved by a lot of books. Just because, you know, once you read a lot, you can kind of see where things right. Are going. And it might be a little bit harder to connect on a level where it's moving, whereas like it's good, but it's not moving. And so I can remember very vividly certain authors where I was moved by their writing, and I remember them fondly. I can list them off and be like, yeah, this moment in this book is when I fell in love.
Right. No, that's exactly it. Like sometimes it takes me like a, sometimes it's more of like a broad spectrum of like, oh, these elements of the stories really, I really connect with these elements of the stories, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, no, one of my newer favorite authors and favorite series, like, it's not even a sad book. Like, the books themselves are, they're not like sad. They're like a fantasy adventure. But there was like, in like the third book of the series, I want to say, there was this moment where I started crying and I was like, why am I crying? Nothing sad is happening. But it was just the circumstance that our main character was in. Was so like, and the emotions that the main character was going through were so like similar to some of my own experiences, or like just this concept that I was really, really touched me, that I was just like, why am I crying over this fantasy adventure right now? It was that's when I knew that this was it, that was it for me.
Yeah, I think that being able to have that connection with a potential reader for yourself would probably be a very wonderful experience to be able to share that. And so with the desire for connection, do you have a goal of reaching a large audience, or are you looking to even just one person is enough for you?
And I think there's definitely something to be said for like quantity of people. Like, I would love to have a large audience of devoted fans in the sense of like, like not like huge. Or I'm not looking for like, you know, I don't want to get mobbed at paparazzi level, you know, but like the idea of like knowing that there's this like really diehard group out there. Like, I'd love it to be a lot of people, but you know, like. It is what it is. Like, I would rather have like 10 really devoted fans versus 100 people who think I'm okay. If that makes sense. Like, I mean, obviously 100 people lead to more sales, which is, you know, when you have to consider writing as a business, it's always a factor. But, you know.
No, I can understand that. I definitely, kind of feel the same way with what I have written. I'd rather have like, you know, maybe 5 people who are like, that was great, than 50 people who are like, eh, I mean, it was okay. I enjoyed it. 5 out of 10. Right. 6 out of 10. But I want to move a little bit to publishing as a whole. I know we've talked a little bit about when it comes to difficulty with transparency with publishing, to understand if it's welcoming to your points of view and your voice. Do you feel that the world of publishing is showing an increasing understanding of the levels of diversity within your community and your background? Or would you say that it's difficult to tell because of the lack of transparency? Because we mentioned that a little bit before.
Right. I definitely have to look at kind of like what's out there already. Okay, like you have to kind of look at like, okay, what's been picked to be published? Because I think that's going to tell you like what publishing is trying to do. And so speaking from so it's hard to speak from like the queer community because it's already extremely fucking diverse. It's already very, very diverse. And so there is definitely an element there of I definitely see it from from a queer perspective of I have yet to see my specific combination of queerness show up in traditional publishing books. There's like several indie books that have like really like hit it, but I have yet to really see it a lot in traditional publishing because they tend to I think trad publishing is trying to be safe. And so it's like, oh, we're going to, oh yeah, okay, so we're going to create these queer narratives. We're gonna create safe queer narratives. Things that also appeal to like non-queer people and people outside, the alphabet soup. And so they end up going very safe, or they end up still adhering to narratives that people are this is hard to describe this. They adhere to like familiar queer narratives in that like queerness as a primary conflict. Like, oh, you're gay, therefore that's the conflict of the story, you being gay. And it's like you still see that a lot when you don't necessarily need to. I think that's an artifact of publishing trying to like catch up. And I definitely see growth. I definitely see growth in general. Like there's definitely a lot more gay books basically out there than there used to be. And you are seeing more trans characters, a lot of YA. A lot of YA is really pushing it. But that in itself is more of an issue. Like that there's a whole complex thing there. But you are seeing it more and more. You're seeing things like you are slightly seeing things like Iron Widow. Like Iron Widow with a presumably with a bot with a non-binary author, a woman main character whose relationship with gender is not very strict and definitely reads more like gender queer and non-binary, and then two bisexual male characters and the three of them being in a polyamorous triad, and that's being a YA book. That's huge. That's a huge like thing, and it took Zhao like forever to get that book seen. But it's an exception, not the rule. It's an exception, not the rule. And so while you still see a big growth in queer books in YA and in some adult, they're still in safe. The narratives are still safe. They're still safe narratives. Like oh, it's two boys, and it's just like oh, they're in love and whatever. So that's tricky. That's one of those things where we're gonna have to kind of wait to see like how that grows. But they're trying. They are trying, if only just because they know that stuff sells. Like it's like they know that people will buy it. Like I know what I'm like. If I'm like if I go to the bookstore and like I have two options and this book is all straight characters and which is like not representative of the people I know and it's like my friend group, we're all queer, to some degree. So if I see like a book that's all straight people and a book that's like, oh, we have a diverse mix of different kinds of queer and trans and whatever, I'm gonna pick the second book. I'm gonna pick the book that mimics my real life friend group a little bit more because I just, it's a thing. And so there's definitely a monetary issue there. And so I think they're finally realizing, oh my God, we can tap this market financially. Why weren't we doing this we want their money. It's you can see it being very financially motivated, but hopefully it also catches up in regards to actually understanding what that community looks like and developing books that actually match the lived experiences of the community as opposed to just selling to the community. There's a distinction there. I feel like we're still kind of on the edge of. And then again, this is an audio medium. I'm a fat person, and like we gotta have more fat pro tags, y'all. Especially in romance. Like, oh my God, romance is so bad because what romance will do is they'll have a fat protagonist, but they'll spend half the book being like complaining about being fat. And it's like, no, let the woman eat a cheesecake. Like, right. So like that's something that I can say for sure needs to get fixed. That they are not on top of. And indie publishing is doing a much better job of. Trad publishing is not. Across all genres, but indie publishing is kind of doing a little better on. So.
Yeah, I definitely think it ends up being a point of conflict rather than just a point of existence.
Right. Like I'm fat and I live in the world, and never ever in my day-to-day life, except when I have to go buy clothes, is my fatness a conflict. I'm just existing. Just write a story about that. Write a story about a fat person existing. Like it does not have to be that complicated. I'm doing that. I'm working on that. Cause even I even don't think about it. I'm like, man, why am I making this character a size 2? Why am I doing that? I don't know what that's like. And then I'm like, let's up that. She's 18 now at least.
Yeah, that is a good point. It's not something I even actively think about, but now that you brought it up, I think my characters have been. I've just naturally made them slimmer. Not necessarily like super thin.
Right.
I don't necessarily think of them that way, but they are definitely not fat. Not for any particular reason. I'm not against it. It just doesn't happen.
Even as a fat person, I don't think about it. Because to me, it's like, it's one of those things. You're thinking about it. And when you actually sit and think about it for a minute, you're like, huh. Huh. Hmm. Is that internalized fat phobia? What is that? What have I done here?
Yeah. I'm not sure, but it's something to think about.
Right. It's something to think about. It's something you don't think about. And then when you do, you're like, oh, huh. Why do I do that?
I think this goes back wonderfully to what you said earlier about internalized biases that we don't necessarily notice.
Yeah. And it's things. Yeah, exactly.
So I guess it. Maybe you've already answered this question, but just to make it into a neat thing, if there's one message you could get to the publishing community to hear and understand, what would that be?
So this is very much a people want to read books. They want to read weird books. They want to experience things that are obviously you have some people in the reading community that they want the same thing over and over again. You don't have to worry about those people will find what they want. It's fine. But like there are large parts of the reading community that want new and interesting and weird things. And like most of the books I pick up like over the course of the years, sometimes I'll see them on the shelf at the store, but lots of times I'm picking them up. I'm getting recommendations from other people because the things that the publisher is like promoting, like I get ads from publishers on my Facebook a lot because Facebook algorithm, and they'll advertise a book and I'm like, I don't want to read that book that you just advertised to me. Like I recently got an advertisement for a book where I was like, oh, it sounds interesting. And I read like the fuller description and I was like, no. Ew, I don't want to read that. Why are you even publishing this book? Like, why have you advertised this to me? This is absolutely not what I want. So I'm getting recommendations from other people who are finding books that do not get mainstream advertising that I wouldn't be able to find in a store if I wanted to. So it's like you have this diversity of books that are getting published. But they're not showing up in store shelves. They're not getting like the sort of like off the shelf exposure kind of thing. Like I posted in one of my reading groups, I had just finished a book recently. And every time I finish the book, I'm like, oh my God, this book I just read, this is what it's like. And the instant I post about this book, I'm getting recommendations of books that are similar to it that I'm just like, add to my list. And it's like, none of this is happening in actual advertising market. This is all word of mouth. And if the publishing community understood that, how much stronger the word of mouth recommendation is versus, oh, I'm going to throw you a Facebook ad. I think they would have a much better understanding of what people actually want to read and the hunger for different and strange and peculiar books that are out there, that they would realize they don't have to play it safe. You know, like they can take chances on weirder things because people want to read them. They're sharing it with each other. It's just, you're not marketing the weird books. You're having, like, they're languishing and they're not selling because you're not pushing them. People want to read weird stuff. And you keep letting it just slide away.
I guess this, the message would be to not just have diversity of publication, but also diversity of marketing.
Right. Diversity of marketing. And then it's like, oh, you'll pick like your two books that you're going to push. And then, oh, but you've also put out 20 other books this year that are all very different, but I didn't know about those at all. Mm. Like, I don't know how people keep up with new releases because I don't see book advertisements. Like, I have specific authors I follow and I know when their next books are coming out.
Right.
But like, as far as like just finding new authors, like I'm lucky if I'll be like ever so often I'll go to like the big Barnes and Noble, where I'm more likely to find someone I didn't know before, but like I'll be flipping through and then be like, oh, I haven't heard of this author, but this sounds cool. But most of the time I'm coming in with already an idea of like, oh yeah, I saw this book. I wanted to grab it next time I saw it. Oh my goodness, it's actually here. Yoink. But like Barnes & Noble didn't sell that to me. The publisher didn't sell that to me. Some dude on TikTok sold that book to me.
Right.
Because they thought it was great. So it's like...
I definitely understand, because most of the books that I've read over the years have actually just been recommendations. Like when I was younger, it was my parents. My parents would be like, particularly my father would push, would be like, hey, I read this book, it's really good, we have it here, try it out. And I'd end up reading it and loving it a lot of the time. And then he'd be like, oh, you like that book? Why, I was checking out these other books, would you be interested in reading them with me? And then as I've grown older, I have friends where I'm like, I read this book recently, what have you been reading recently? And they're like, I read this book recently, and we trade books that we read. And that's actually most of my reading.
The books I grew up on were the books we already had in the house. Like, just my mom had read it at some point and it was up on the shelf and she was like, oh yeah, I liked it, do you want to read it? Sure. West of Eden by Harry Harrison. Shoink. Prey by Michael Crichton. That had me reading Michael Crichton really early. My mom was a fan. I'm the exact same way. And then I also go to the library. The library was really big because I could bike to it. And so my dad and I would go there like every other Friday. So I had access to both what was in the house, what was in the library for the longest time. And then now as an adult, it's more like, okay, I've read all those. Those books are like, those are the more mainstream books. And so now it's like book talk. I'm on TikTok, you know? And so like, I'm getting recommendations there, or I'm in like a whole bunch of like reading groups online. And like, they'll be like, oh my God, I just picked up this book, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to read that, but thank you for bringing it to my attention. It's recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's trusting the community to find it, the books that you're putting out there.
Yep.
And also trusting that the books will have a community that will want to read them. Yeah, I think that is a very good point of trusting the readers to exist. There's a lot of people reading.
Right, exactly. There's other people. God, I think we're at the highest level of like per capita readers in the past like 20 years or something right now. Like there are more people reading now than in like the past 40 years or something stupid like that. So yeah.
So I think that's a wonderful message to leave it off on. I'd like to thank you, Ash, for talking with me today, from being on the Writer's Triangle. And thank you to all of our beautiful moss for listening. Ash, can you tell us where to find you on social media?
Absolutely. So you can find me. So my handle du jour, my handle that I use is Pixels and Pins, P-I-X-E-L-S and Pins, P-I-N-S. It's old handle. We can find the pixelsandpins.com. My Twitter, my Instagram, my TikTok are all Pixels and Pins. So you can find me there, and it's all linked on my website. So I'm pretty easy to find.
Wonderful. And be sure to visit cinnabarmoth.com or cinnabarmothliterarycollections.com and check out the transcripts. And we'll also have Ash's social media links. Mm-hmm. Ash, thank you again for coming on today. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Absolutely.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for listening, and bye-bye.